Hey you, are you wasting your time on social media again? Your brothers and sisters in Islam Net from Norway are establishing a masjid, a dawah center. Establishing a masjid to convey the message of Islam is one of the best deeds a Muslim can do. There's a huge need for it in Norway. You know this and I know this. So that makes the reward even greater. So give generously and Allah Azza wa Jal will give you even more.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you guys doing? And welcome to another episode of the MH podcast with one very special guest who, whenever comes on this podcast, everyone becomes very interested. And you're presenting so many facts, so much information, but nevertheless, people are not growing tired of it or bored of it. So it's very interesting to have you here again.
Thank you.
But when we were talking about before we decided to go do a podcast again, and we were talking about the stuff that you've got, the information that you've got, you really said some shocking and interesting things, especially about my last encounter with Morgan that for me went under the radar. So maybe we should start there. Some of the things that he said, and what did you notice?
So I think to understand the wider operation, it is important for us to look at Rupert Murdoch and his empire. So for instance, your co-guest on the previous episode was Alan Dershowitz. Now, Alan Dershowitz recently published an article.
Dershowitz, we had a good time with him.
Absolutely. titled, How Innocent Are Civilians in Gaza? Now, this article was carried in the New York Post newspaper, which is also owned by Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch owns Talk TV. He owns The Sun. He owns Sky News, which has actually fired a reporter for her questioning of the Israeli ambassador in a particular fashion that the Israeli ambassador took issue with during this period. But Murdoch also has a very interesting history with Israeli intelligence that I think is worthy of note. So Murdoch owned something called the NDS Group. The NDS Group was a tech organization that was accused of hacking the competition of Rupert Murdoch's media companies and placing at one point their services online for free. So this is in a period of time around the 2000s when LimeWire and stuff like that was quite popular. But what Murdoch is not really held accountable for is the fact that this organization, the NDS Group, was staffed by former Israeli intelligence figures, the former deputy director of Israel's internal intelligence agency. But where it gets really interesting is that the same time that Murdoch was cultivating this organization, the NDS Group, his newspaper, the Sunday Times, was confided in by Mordecai Vanunu. Now, Mordecai Vanunu was an Israeli individual that worked on Israel's nuclear project. who worked on their...
He sounds more like an Indian, really. It doesn't sound like a Hebrew name to me.
I mean, he's quite a fascinating figure because it could be my pronunciation. If I was to pronounce it correctly, it may sound more Ibri. But he was somebody that came to the Sunday Times and said, look, I want to reveal the secrets of Israel's nuclear plan. I want to reveal the secrets. Now, Andrew Neil at the time, who you obviously will have seen on the popular BBC show, you know, he has a history of really hammering his guests, and particularly
with Ben Shapiro. He had one.
He was great against Ben Shapiro. I wish he was like that with more prominent Zionists. But
after that that particular interview, even Ben Shapiro admitted defeat.
Oh, absolutely. He defeated him. A resounding defeat.
Yeah.
A drumming even. But Andrew Neil at that time was the editor of the Sunday Times. Now, Mordecai Vanunu, while under the care of the Sunday Times, which was...
I don't know why this thing.
I mean,
sorry.
It would be amazing to interview Mordecai Vanunu, yeah. But he's actually, off the back of what happened during that period, he cannot communicate with foreigners. He's legally banned from communicating with foreigners. So what happened was, is he reveals Israel's project, Dimona, and
Did he reveal it publicly?
Yeah, it was then published in the Sunday Times. However, during the time he was under the protection of Murdoch's company, Mossad kidnapped him from Europe and took him to occupied Palestine, where he has been imprisoned for tens of years. He's been released now.
This is very serious. Like, how comes we don't see this on like the news? Was it on the news?
Absolutely. I mean, it was covered, but it's very much kind of petered out, I would say. The attention to the story, unfortunately. He does have a Twitter, but again, he is officially banned from communicating with foreign citizens.
Really?
And my question on this subject is it conceivable that Rupert Murdoch, simultaneous to owning the company that was being confided in about Israel's secret nuclear program, had a company that was literally its whole fertilization took place at the Chaim Weizmann Institute of Technology. This was an organization that was an Israeli company that was again staffed purely by Israeli military and intelligence personnel. He was clearly not an objective place or a neutral place, shall we say, for Vanunu to entrust his safety with. But then there was another thing that Piers Morgan said, which I think is worth further inquiry. Now, there was a point when you were pressing him on the issue of the picture with Ghislaine Maxwell.
Yeah.
Now, he had a sentence which he did not complete, which I think it would be interesting to find from the episode and possibly play, when he mentions her father and implies that there was a personal relationship between him and Ghislaine Maxwell's father. Yeah. Now, Ghislaine Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell, was a British politician, was the owner of the Daily Mirror prior to Piers Morgan becoming the editor. However, he was also an Israeli intelligence asset. Now, it has been reported that Maxwell even used funds from the Daily Mirror to fund Israeli intelligence operations in Europe.
Really?
So if he's pulling back from stating to you that he had a person...
Do you remember what he said?
I think he was referencing the reason for him being at the party and meeting Ghislaine.
Yeah.
And so he was explaining it. I mean, we'd have to get the clip and play it back. And I think he was mentioning her father and he stopped himself in his tracks, possibly because what's coming under more attention now is the relationships of media figures with Israeli intelligence people. And it does, you know, lead on to this issue of the Netanyahu funder's letter, because when I went on the show, I mentioned this letter and showed it, and that it had Rupert Murdoch's name on it. And it reveals, you know, what I would say is a kind of a network of prominent individuals who perceive themselves as having shared interest with inserting Netanyahu into power. And you have to remember that this this note was compiled.
So where did this exactly come from?
So this note, which is the one that was held up by myself on the Piers Morgan show, we have a version which has clearer writing, which hopefully in editing we'll be able to show on the screen. Now, this was leaked to the Israeli media from Netanyahu's political office in his election campaign in the late 2000s. So this is prior to him becoming prime minister. These names are of individuals which he considered to be funders of his campaign. And so on this...
There's some names that are circled and stuff like that. Why is that?
It's unclear. Netanyahu's political office engaged in crisis management on this subject and tried to obscure some of the information.
And some names are in print and some names are written by hand.
Exactly. And this handwriting is Netanyahu's handwriting.
Really?
But I think it's necessary for us to go through some of these names because they reveal...
Can I just say that if they've written these... Like, if this is in print and this is by handwriting, that this is like the main list, if you like, and this is like the added ones that maybe the brainstorming session that they had that they put on there.
Certainly, certainly.
And they put Rupert Murdoch in the main list, in the printed one, right?
Yeah, printed. Yeah. And so it it certainly implies that he would have, and also Donald Trump is there.
Oh.
Leslie Wexner is there, who relates to the Epstein case strongly.
Is Biden there?
No.
Really?
But Haim Saban is there, who is somebody that is currently credited as writing Joe Biden's script, policy-wise, on Israel. But we can go into some of these names. But as I said, you know, Rupert Murdoch is somebody that has used his position within the media to back Israel strongly. Has we found documents showing that his charitable arm has funded something called the Jerusalem Foundation.
Yeah, you are on Piers.
Talking
probing
about
him about that, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Would you condemn Rupert Murdoch? It's become a trend now, actually.
Well, I mean, it should do, because I think he's an interesting psychological warrior in that he is able to enjoy a kind of performed neutrality in which it's much like the BBC says news without bias, not as a legitimate and accurate description, but as a perception it wants you to have of it.
And Morgan is this, like, he'll have like three or four things which he'll condemn, or which he'll, you know, be openly against the settlements or whatever, but he's doing that to feign this neutrality, isn't it?
Absolutely. And then he strikes very cleanly on people that he's identified, and he said this, identified as extremists. And I also think there's an aspect of the policy which is to keep away Palestinians who are not part of the normalization project. So he will have a representative of the Palestinian Authority, for example, which is the institutionalization of normalization within Palestine. But he'll get non-Palestinian Arabs on the show, or others from the West, but he will not get Palestinians that are directly involved in what's happening in Gaza, for example.
How would he be able to do that?
There's plenty of people, you know. Ahmed Al-Nawq, for example, is a capable, very, very good speaker, done many media appearances, lost 21 members of his family.
Okay.
I've never seen Piers Morgan, for
that
example,
would be a good one,
go to interview him, but he's then, because it's also part of, I would argue, the criminalization of the community in this country.
Yeah.
He's trying to push us into a place where pronouncements are made, which can then be legally actionable.
Yeah.
So, you know, without a legal representative with you, you are dealing with somebody who, you know, and in the case, of course, of...
my case, Dershowitz
was threatening legal action. Yes.
Very litigious man he was.
Yes, and he is, and he is. I mean, the thing with Alan Dershowitz, which I think is important to take into account.
Is he on the list?
He's not. But Leslie Wexner, who is close to him, is on the list. But Dershowitz is somebody who has stated that he's worked for Israel for decades.
Yeah.
He's somebody that...
He says that he's the attorney of...
Of Israel.
Of Israel. What does he mean by that?
Well, there was one point when he was... due to be a defense lawyer for Israel
in the ICJ
and then they pulled back from it when they realized, I think, that he was a bit of a liability in terms of PR. But his role has been very interesting, because when Qatar was blockaded by the Saudis and other Gulf states, he traveled to Qatar to threaten the Qataris, particularly on one issue. So Al Jazeera had an amazing documentary called The Lobby, where they went undercover in the Israel lobby in this country and revealed many different schemes to even bring down Alan Duncan, who was a conservative minister at the time, just because he was slightly supportive of the idea of Palestinian statehood. They uncovered really the whole Corbyn operation was exposed in terms of the operation against Corbyn was exposed expertly by the Lobby documentary. But then they had a US episode. Now, the reason that the US episode never aired on Al Jazeera, it was again an infiltration of the Israel lobby in the United States. It never aired on Al Jazeera. It was leaked to Electronic Intifada. Was because, well, part of the reasoning was Alan Dershowitz. Alan Dershowitz went to Qatar and threatened that the United States would remove their bases from Qatar and it would open the way for Saudi invasion.
No way.
Yeah. This is documented
this,
fact.
This is like on that level that he's got that kind of leverage.
Yes.
He went to Qatar and threatened them.
Representing the Israeli government, yes.
Really?
Yeah. So this is all, you know, this is all relevant, I would say, to his media work also.
Yeah.
But in terms of, say, for example, you've got Leslie Wexner here.
Yeah.
Now, Leslie Wexner.
Who is she?
It's an individual, it's a man who... very highly connected at Harvard University, key funder there.
It's one of those unisex names.
Yeah. But he, for example, and this is really interesting, had a foundation which was listed as one of the Israeli Prime Minister's office's projects.
Okay.
So if he has a history of funding Netanyahu, and then you have a situation where he's able to use his influence, but you know, his involvement, Leslie Wexner specifically, his involvement with not only Epstein but also individuals involved in sexual blackmail goes back a long way. Maya Lansky is believed to have been
what do you mean by sexual blackmail?
Well, this was the Epstein project, was compromat. It was building compromat on targets, people identified often as allies. But the practice we know of it being carried out by intelligence agencies goes back to the 30s, 40s, when Maya Lansky, who's somebody associated with Leslie Wexner, carried it out for the OSS. Now, the OSS, Office for Strategic Services, is a precursor of the CIA. It later became the CIA post-Second World War. And Wexner takes Epstein under his wing. And Epstein's...
Really?
Epstein's position at Harvard. You know, Epstein also worked for Adnan Khashoggi, not Jamal Khashoggi, Adnan, who was involved in arms dealing, who had extensive work with Israeli intelligence agencies. But the decisive point when we look at Epstein is the fact when he got the sweetheart deal that Dershowitz helped obtain for him, which was not going to jail in any serious way. Alex Acosta, who was the US...
journalist as well?
No. Alex Acosta was a US state attorney at the time. He said, I was told not to touch Epstein because he's intelligence. He didn't specify which intelligence agency he worked for. But then Stephen Hoffenberg, who was very close to Epstein, and who eventually died in his home in Derby in the United States, wasn't discovered for 7 days. Stephen Hoffenberg claimed that Epstein would boast about building compromat through this use of sexual blackmail on individuals like Prince Andrew for Israeli intelligence services. So this is somebody that would have known.
Very manipulative tactic. It's like absolutely the heart of... But it's incredible, like, how many of these guys have leverage on each other at this level.
Absolutely. And then what you have to think about is the period when Epstein was engaging and building compromat, potentially, on US President Bill Clinton, is the same time that several...
Allegedly.
Yeah. Potentially building compromat. But there's several really interesting things that Clinton did during that period, which I think need to be revisited. بعين الاعتبار of this information.
Yeah.
So, Jonathan Pollard was a US naval intelligence officer. Now, his activity within the US security state has become an issue of legendary intrigue. He spied for the Israeli government and was caught by the US and imprisoned. Jonathan Pollard was. Some of the things that he did, he obtained millions of classified documents from the US military. He also obtained information which helped with Israel's secret nuclear plan. But he also, this is the same time that the Promise software was downloaded onto the US classified databases, which gave Israel a backdoor to US classified information. Now, the interesting thing here is that Netanyahu approaches Bill Clinton to ask him to pardon Jonathan Pollard. But when he approaches him, it's been reported that he says, "We have evidence of your affair with Monica Lewinsky."
Who says it?
Netanyahu says to Bill Clinton, "We have evidence of your affair with Monica Lewinsky through the hacking of your phone." however,
oh my God.
The interesting question is, was Epstein's engagement of Clinton also a factor in Netanyahu's approach? Yeah. So Clinton then goes to Robert Gates, Rumsfeld, and he says to them, "I'm newly convinced by Netanyahu's argument that we should release Jonathan Pollard."
Wow.
At which point, Rumsfeld, Robert Gates,
oh my God,
and possibly Dick Cheney, if my memory is serving me well, say they will resign.
Really?
If you release Jonathan Pollard, who's been imprisoned for spying on our most sensitive information.
No way.
Involvement in the Promise scandal.
Where did you find this information? Where can we find this? Someone says, well, what are the sources for this information?
I mean, this is widely covered. It's really, covered in the Israeli media. And actually, where we get into the Murdoch question with the very newspaper which leaked this letter. Netanyahu then asked Murdoch's sons to buy the newspaper.
Really,
yeah. So the relationship is that close between Murdoch and Netanyahu. But in terms of the Clinton story, there's more to it, because they did not obtain the pardoning of Jonathan Pollard. However, you have Mark Rich and Pincus Green. Now, these...
So what happened to Jonathan Pollard?
He was later released under Obama and went to occupied Palestine and kissed the tarmac when he exited the plane.
Wow. So how long did he spend in prison?
Over 20 years.
Ooh.
It was a serious situation. And Jonathan Pollard is today making pronouncements on the internet about what should be done with the Palestinians. And, you know, he's been taken in. But there were individuals involved in the Promise scandal, which Ghislaine Maxwell's father was largely involved with.
So they're all into the same things.
This is the axis of insistence. And the axis of insistence is the maximalist, fantastical Zionist aims for the region. It is imperial Israel. It is air supremacy. It is control of curriculums. It is cultural change. And so that's where we have a transnational group of individuals involved in it, but now states have been commandeered to these objectives. Because I don't think it can necessarily still be argued that this is a situation of Israel being a bulwark of British and US imperialism. You have British government funding to Israel lobby groups and groups which are seeking to obtain public contracts in this country for Israeli tech companies.
Yeah.
Funded by the British government.
How do we...
So how is it that Israel is this instrument of the United States and Britain?
Yeah.
Which is... This is an analysis which I think if you are looking at...
So you think it's the other way around. Do you think that it's Israel that's manipulating these great powers?
I think it's a tug of war.
Is it?
I don't think it's... I think it's now...
Yeah.
70-30.
Really?
Where Israel has such an integrated relationship with the security services and the militaries of these countries, that it is seen as, yes, it's the eyes on the ground, yes, it's the boots on the ground, but it's seen as the decision maker in what's happening here. Because the British are not sending the R1 shadow plane over the top of Gaza, likely to help with target acquisition, because it aids British imperialism. I don't see that as ringing true. I believe they are sending it as part of a secret military agreement with the Israelis that has certain requirements when any of the states enter war. So if Britain enters war, Israel will have to provide some form of service. When Israel's entered war, Britain is providing some form of service. It has a secret spy team in Israel, which is assisting with the campaign. It's issued a D-notice on the SAS activities early on in the war. Why would it? And so a D-notice is where the government contacts journalists and say, do not publish information about this, please. It's damaging to national security. They issued that on SAS operations in Gaza.
Really?
Why would they do that? Mm. Why would they do that? If there was no SAS operations in Gaza, if you did not have British secret forces, special forces active in Gaza, they would not issue a D-notice at all.
And
we of course have the reports from Gaza now that the US special forces, and even Biden confirmed it after the assassination of Yahya Sinwar, which, you know, we can touch on, Biden seeking to take credit to some extent, says US special forces have been involved from the very beginning, which we said early on. We said the US Delta Force is there. We've got the pictures. Alakullan, this particular Epstein angle, though,
yeah,
and the way in which it's interesting on the decisions of Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
So one other aspect of Clinton's activity during that time, which yeah, I believe may have had the influence of Epstein, was the case of Pincus Green and Mark Rich.
So who are they?
Now, these are individuals who fit the description of Sayanim. Sayanim are, in Hebrew, it's a term used to describe Mossad agents that act within the business capacity.
Okay.
So they are called upon to provide specific services for Israeli intelligence. So Mark Rich, for example, was involved in a logistics company in the Middle East.
Yeah.
So it was a route through which, yeah, Israel at that time was able to gain access to what was happening in countries like Iraq, yeah, where they didn't have access through traditional means.
Yeah.
And so Pincus Green and Mark Rich, my understanding is that they were wanted by the FBI for tax evasion.
Okay.
Now, they fled the United States.
Who are they again?
They are two Israeli agents.
Basically.
Yeah. Okay. And they fled the United States and
They lived in the United States.
And they fled, yeah. And they were wanted for tax evasion.
Okay.
Now, Ehud Barak, who again is a very, very key collaborator.
The rule is that if you go to Israel, they will protect you from all that.
Well, this is what happened, yeah, right? So Ehud Barak was at that time the prime minister. And he was very close to Epstein. Very, very close. Really? Business partners.
He's coming out speaking about he was on Piers Morgan's show.
Yeah.
He had a piece with Piers Morgan as well.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's interesting. There's a network here. There's, yeah, a nexus here of individuals.
Yeah.
But Ehud Barak obviously is from the more Ben-Gurion side of the Zionist movement. Mm. And I think we have, unfortunately, sometimes an understanding of the Zionist movement that poses Ben-Gurion and Jabotinsky, Ehud Barak and Netanyahu as diametrically opposed to each other. I don't think it's that they're diametrically opposed.
Mm.
The argument being that Ben-Gurion supported British rule in Palestine and Jabotinsky fought British rule. That Ehud Barak supports supposedly a two-state solution, but Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't. I don't think it's that they're diametrically opposed in objectives as such. I think they are more... There is a divergence on the way that you manage the PR of the situation. Okay. That's
what about strategy, like military? Because he was saying,
of course, Barak, the strategy is different
on the Morgan show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That there's got to be an end game, and if there's no end game, then this is a foolishness, etc.
Yeah, and we'll
slightly critical.
Absolutely, and I mean they are political opponents.
Yeah.
So even in the case of Ben-Gurion and Jabotinsky, they'd call each other Nazis and Hitler. And, and again, you'll hear that kind of discourse when it comes to Ehud Barak and Netanyahu. So they are political opponents. But yeah. And the end game is an interesting question here, which I think we need to get into when we look at the axis of assistance and the axis of resistance.
The axis of insistence?
So the axis of insistence, yeah, is these individuals who are working to commandeer the states,
yep,
and the states that are working for the expansion of Zionism.
Okay.
That's what this is. What's happening now is about the expansion of Zionism in the region. But just to get to this case of Mark Rich and Pincus Green, Clinton pardoned them. And he pardoned them following the intervention of Ehud Barak and the head of Israel's external intelligence agency, Mossad. Now,
why?
it's my belief that the engagement by Epstein would have played a role.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So what we're talking about is the president of the most powerful state in the world being blackmailed by Israel into taking particular decisions at particular times. Again, it's a tug of war. So there were some things that Israel was able to obtain, and there were some things that Israel wasn't able to obtain. And the thing that Israel wasn't able to obtain was the release of Jonathan Pollard, which was a big, big deal. Again, the list we could go on, there's really important people here that I do think we, you know, there's several funders of Michael Gove here. There's Zach Gertler. Michael Gove? Yeah. Yeah.
Our Michael Gove here in the UK.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Zach
is he an important figure? Like, you know, why is he even got, why is he even on the list?
Well, he's not on the list, but the people that funded him are. So Manny Weiss and Zach Gertler have both pumped money into Michael Gove's operations. Ronald Perelman is one of the early investors in Marvel Comics. Of course, Marvel would launder pro-Israel propaganda in a lot of its comics. And now
can you give us an example of that?
So they have the a former IDF soldier they depicted. They also were planning a film, a Marvel film, which seems to have fallen by the wayside, which was of an Israeli soldier, a woman. So Marvel have interesting connections with that, but then you have the example here of Eyal Ofer, who is again listed here as a potential funder of Benjamin Netanyahu. So Eyal Ofer is from the Ofer family, which is one of, if not the richest families in Israel.
Okay.
Now, this family was found by the Times newspaper in 2011 to be using its shipping company, Zodiac Maritime, to ferry elite agents for Israel across the region to carry out assassinations.
Yeah.
So, for example, Yasser Arafat's head of intelligence, Abu Jihad, when he was killed in Tunis, it was Zodiac Maritime who moved the Israeli agents to Tunisia to carry out the operation. You have Al-Mabhouh, the Hamas head of military procurement, who was killed in Dubai in 2010 by Israeli agents, who at that time used fake British passports. They were transported by Zodiac Maritime. So Zodiac Maritime has an interesting role in this whole war, because when the Yemeni armed forces, so they're owned by Eyal Ofer.
What are they? What's Zodiac Maritime?
So Zodiac Maritime is a shipping company.
Okay.
It's a shipping company which has been used as a front. This is the very.
Where is that company based?
British.
Is it British? Yeah.
Yeah. British.
Company's
registered.
House.
Yes.
No way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Are there many companies like that that work like this?
We know of a few.
Really?
Yeah. But Zodiac Maritime is one of the most prominent. But most interestingly, it is guarded by a company which is an offshoot of the British Ministry of Defence, Ambry Security.
Guarded in terms of security?
Yeah. In the Red Sea.
Where is it?
It's in London.
Really?
Yeah. But so think about this. This is the extent of British involvement. So hold on. Israel is a bulwark of British imperialism. Yeah. How is it possible that you have company that operates from Britain that has been involved in assassinations? This is well documented.
Are the directors British?
Eyal Ofer is Israeli.
Is there any directors that are British? Have you seen that?
If I remember correctly, yes.
Yeah, okay. And shareholders? What's the...
I don't know.
Is it a mix of? Is it?
I think it's owned directly by the Offer family.
Yeah, because you can have a foreign national being a director of a
absolutely.
British company. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
So that's pretty significant, isn't it?
It is very significant. Donald Trump is also listed here, considered by Netanyahu to be a funder in terms of making him prime minister. Yeah. You also have Chaim Saban. Now, Chaim Saban is an Israel lobbyist, the largest. fundraiser for the Friends of the IDF in the history of the organization.
Really?
He's credited today with writing Biden's script on Israel. But more interesting than all of that, he is currently a director of Universal Music Group. Now, Universal Music Group...
It's got all those rappers in it now, isn't it?
It's got DJ Khaled.
Ah!
So DJ Khaled...
That's why he's silent, this man.
We've had a year of silence. Links up with DJ Khaled to see. Yeah. But so you've had a year of silence from DJ Khaled during...
He's Palestinian, isn't he?
Exactly. And so then the question If you have, and it's not only Chaim Saban.
Wait, so can you, let's make this, this is interesting. Can, let's make this
crystallize
very,
this.
Let's really. So who's connected to DJ Khaled?
So Chaim Saban is a director of Universal Music Group. Former Israeli soldier, the largest fundraiser for the Israeli military in the history of the Friends of the IDF, credited with writing Biden's policy on Israel.
Okay.
This is the label DJ Khaled is signed to.
What's his connection to Universal?
He's a director.
He's director?
He's one of the directors.
One of the directors, yeah.
Of Universal Music.
So if Khaled says something, he'll drop him. Potentially.
Not necessarily drop him, but it would cause potential problems, without a doubt. So yeah, there's a lot more in this.
So do you think it's conceivable? One might argue,
yes,
that you know he's being told explicitly, like, do not get involved in the politics in the Middle East.
I mean, certainly implicitly, it's probably been communicated to him
that he probably shrugged his shoulders and said, you know what, I don't want to talk about it anyway.
Maybe
because the way he's coming across, like, yeah, you know, in his post, to be honest with you,
big Mehzele. but
he's probably said, you know, I was never thinking of doing it in the first place.
It's sad. It's a sad, but you know, we're living through the equivalent to the sacking of Baghdad in 1258.
Yeah,
we're living through the equivalent to the fall of Andalus in the 1400s, civilizationally speaking. We are now entering an era when Israel's objectives for the region are to overthrow the Iranian government as a ultimate aim.
Yeah, well, so what's going on with that? Why do you think they want to do that? They talk about Iran a lot.
So if you look at the pronouncements of key figures within the organizations involved in practicing their right under UN Resolution 3246, which is the right of Palestinians to armed resistance for an occupation. If you look at, for instance, the words of Ziad al-Nakhala, the Secretary General of Jihad al-Islami. He has stated that Iran has given billions to all Palestinian resistance factions, even Fatah, over the last few decades. If you look at, for instance, Talal Naji.
But they say that Netanyahu allows that all to go through Qatar, etc.
No, that's different. Qatar's funding is for social projects, is for the provision of general assistance, the duties of government. The funding that Iran has provided has been focused on military, on training, on, and it's actually led to quantum leaps in the change of what's happened on the ground, in the ability to target.
Why can't they stop it if they got so much capabilities? Like, for let's talk about this in terms of.
But I think we should also just expand on it first before we talk on those mechanics. So in terms of this relationship. You look back at the Karine 9, which was one of the ships that was stopped of Iranian weapons headed to Gaza.
Okay.
Now, the the figures resistance, this was in Arafat's time, in the, if I remember correctly, the early 2000s.
Okay.
Now, the argument made by some in the resistance factions was this was one ship, and its reason that it was called the Karine 9 is because there was there was another nine, so it was one of 10.
Oh, okay.
And the, and that these ships reached and were able to arm all of the Palestinian resistance factions, including Shuhada al-Aqsa, which is the Fatah group, even at a time when Fatah had political position.
Fatah,
which
has a PLO, for those who.
It's the armed wing of the PLO. I mean, the PLO now is a sort of political body which even includes the PFLP. Technically, the PA is headed by the head of the PLO, which is Mahmoud Abbas. The PA is Oslo. It's Oslo as a bureaucratic manifestation within the lives of Palestinians. It's a servant of the Israeli occupation. The Palestinian Authority arrests, tortures, and even kills Palestinian resistance fighters for Israel. Again, the interesting aspect of this is that its training is outsourced to the British. So you have the British not only training, but arming with small arms, never snipers. So people are being trained within the Palestinian Authority to only be able to shoot from close, because there has been cases of Palestinian Authority personnel turning their weapons on the Israelis. Yeah. And so you had a case even from Mahmoud Abbas's personal guard, an operation launched by him, killing three Israelis at once a few months ago. And then the story is he was later given up by the Palestinian Authority. So in this case of Iran's relationship with the resistance factions is you have all of their leadership, including even Yahya Sinwar in 2014, at a time when there were significant elements of Hamas deeply at odds with Iran's policy in Syria. Yahya Sinwar says throughout this battle that we've had with the Israelis, Iran has continued to support us in every way we could ever ask. At a time when the resistance factions were completely isolated, but also most importantly militarily, it has been seen as a red line for many, many decades to support them in any way. We're talking about training taking place in Iran, in Syria, in Lebanon, the joint operations room.
But
in
let me
Lebanon
give you a
also.
Bit of a devil's advocate position on this, on Iran, because this would seem to indicate that okay, Iran's been always there, like arming the, you know, the military factions, etc. But then if you look at some of the history between Iran and Israel, some could argue, or one could argue, that there has been some friendly relationships between them as well. So, for example, obviously, famously, the Contra affair.
Iran-Contra affair, yes.
The Iran-Contra affair. And there's some documents have come out to indicate that Israel was actually selling some of the weaponry and stuff like that to Iran as well.
So with the Iran-Contra affair, you had Oliver North basically work on a way in which the United States was able to invisibilize its policy. And so that was involved in the Contras in Nicaragua, basically selling drugs in order to fund their operations. And even some of those drugs ended up in the United States. So, for example, you have the original Rick Ross, not the rapper who's a former correctional officer. Yeah. The drug dealer who was sentenced to 27 years was approached by Gary Webb, a journalist for the Los Angeles Times, who said to him, "Do you know that you were running crack cocaine for the CIA inside the black community?" And he couldn't believe it, because these were CIA agents from the Contras. And so the way the United States would invisibilize their policy would be by taking the money that they procured by arming Iran in the Iran-Iraq war, and then funneling it to the Contras in Nicaragua. Yeah. Now, here's the question. At that time, you had Iraq and Iran in a war that lasted for 8 years.
We're talking about the 80s here.
We're talking about the 80s. Yeah. We are talking about the United States during that war shooting down Iranian civilian flights. And we're talking about Iran.
They switched allegiance from, first they were backing Saddam, and then they stopped backing Saddam.
They were always backing Saddam. In that war, the United States and the Gulf were always backing Saddam. However, as happens in these wars, you have examples where people will look to escape from isolation to some extent, and also keep the flow of armaments.
Okay.
Now, the allegation is that the US planes which transported the weapons to Iran at that time came from Israel.
Through the companies that they dealt with.
But it was US weapons.
Yeah.
Now
but they put this in, they put this on, like, have you come across a Washington report?
Mm-hmm.
I was reading this in some of the sources, the American sources. It doesn't seem like an allegation, it seems quite plausible.
It seems likely,
yeah.
It seems likely. However, and I have a comparative case in this. In the current war, you have the United States moving weapons from bases in Qatar and Kuwait to Israel. Now, Qatar and Kuwait are both states that have stated policies against Israel. However, the presence of the US base has meant that the transporting of those weapons has happened. I believe it is something that we should mention. It's something that is part of the historical record. In terms of the case of during the Iran-Contra situation and the moving of US weapons from Israel, at that time, Israel was the most significant US base in the region. So think about, we're talking prior to the Gulf War, because the Gulf War was the boon for US military installations in the region, because all of a sudden you have, literally with the exception of Libya, Sudan, Algeria, all of the Arab states joining the United States in a coalition against Iraq. So it's at the time of the Gulf War that the US is able to build up its bases in Saudi and other places. So therefore, if you're going to move US weapons to a Middle Eastern state at that time, the other option would be Diego Garcia. And they could have done that, but Diego Garcia is a bit further away. So in my understanding of the way that these forces have been built up in the region, and again, this is the words of those who are directly involved, it could not have happened without Iranian support. The know-how, the training, the knowledge, the money, just wasn't
there. Do you think Iran is, if you want to put it in like international relations framework, is just acting in a very in a way that's in line with the realist framework? Like, they'll do anything which would serve their interest geopolitically. Like, for example, we mentioned the Contra affair, but another, I think, very prominent example would be the Iraq war. I mean, Iraq obviously is a country with a significant Shiite population, actually a majority Shiite population. And I came across this interview with this the then chief, the chief advisor to Colin Powell. His name is Wilkerson,
I think. He's great.
He's doing a lot of stuff now online as well. And he was saying that in that war, the Iraq war, that the Americans were in contact with Iran and making secret negotiations. Because if we think about the genocide in Palestine, I mean, it's tens of thousands of people being killed, but at the time in Iraq as well, you know, hundreds of thousands of people were being killed. And Iran was not doing anything about it. So there was not really a resistance from that perspective. They weren't trying to stop anything, were they?
No, but at that time also, you've got to remember that the relationship between the PLO and Khomeini preceded the Iranian Revolution. And these relationships were formed, in some cases, in Iraq.
PLO
And Khomeini.
Yeah.
These were formed prior to the Iranian Revolution.
When he was in France.
He was in France at one point, but he was in Iraq before.
But that's the question. I've always wondered this question, you know. If the Westerners knew, I know this is conspiratorial, but if the Westerners knew that this guy is going to go back to his country and lead a revolution.
Well, I mean, they didn't.
Why would they let him on the plane
France? But they wouldn't. They wouldn't. I mean, but we could also use that. There's many historical events. Because
as soon as the plane landed, the revolution started.
Yeah, but I think there's many historical events that we could sort of, looking at them teleologically.
Yeah.
We'd say, why didn't this happen then and this happen then? But, you know, as you know, things get through the cracks. I mean, why would Piers Morgan allow me on his show when I've actually gone online and talked about this list before? Do you know what I mean? People, anyway, I mean, maybe that's not a good comparison.
Yeah.
What you're mentioning is a far more serious, consequential historical event.
Yeah.
But I think on these matters,
yeah,
It's worth deferring to those that have the direct hands-on position in the situation and their testimony. but also the testimony of the enemies. Mm. And the ultimate objective, if you want cultural change, and this is, I guess, where we get into the idea of the axis of resistance and the axis of assistance. Mm. Because the axis of resistance is the only grouping which is materially opposing Israel and stopping it. And it's the only grouping in the region that has been able to impede or at least delay Israel's replacement of Al-Aqsa, which is the ultimate objective, which was the
basic... Could someone argue that really Iran has done no more than any of the other Arab states which are being controlled by the...
No. It's
in terms of direct response. Like, think about it, right? I mean, Iran's been attacked directly, mm-hmm. right? Multiple times, and they've responded in a way which is not even... Like, you know, these attacks that they've had. 16 people died, then they done these drones, no one died.
Every single action of any of the factions in the region, and this is what Israel knows, is an Iranian response. More than that, we're talking about decades of deep integration. We're talking about information sharing.
Yeah.
We're talking about training. We're talking about...
But they've also been sharing information with Israel.
No, they haven't.
I mean, not sharing information, but they did these back deals with America and stuff in the Iran-Iraq
War. No, negotiations with the United States. But you're talking about the 80s. We're talking about 50 years ago.
No, but even the Iraq War recently, according to Wilkerson and all these guys.
No, so what happened with the Iraq invasion, Ghazw al-Iraq, 2003. What we're talking about in that case is that you had different arguments made by some. Yeah. And one of the arguments in both the cases of the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq was that we will cooperate with the political process which is then established in the country.
Mm.
And so then therefore you had specific political parties which were involved in the political process. But I would say to you this, the biggest part of that is that you now have an Iraqi government which has a more pro-Palestine position than states that literally have US bases that flew. You have a relationship between Iraq and Palestine, which, you know, we also can't remove the agency of individual political actors.
Yeah.
So if specific political groups that may or may not have bad reputations for fasad or ta'afiyya inside the society, you cannot necessarily read that as to be blamed on a neighbor that they have a good relationship with.
Mm.
Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and I think sometimes that's what takes place in the Iraqi context. And I think also you have to remember that the entire media system that was established post 2003, it took place under the auspices of the US government. We're talking about the biggest and most important Iraqi news channels, from Al-Sharqiyya to Al-Hurra to Al-Iraqiyya. These are the ways that people are understanding what's happening in the country. These are established by the US government. Al-Sharqiyya wasn't established by the US government. It has a very integrated relationship. Okay, so for example, NBC had this report where they stated that Yahya Sinwar, Ismail Haniyeh, Saleh al-Aruri were terrorists. Now, the response was NBC was shut down by Iraqis and is now in the process of leaving Iraq. And the same for Al-Arabiya. And Al-Arabiya has been working closely with the Israeli military on its reports. But then we get into, and I think it's important, because what you're kind of pointing to is a distinction between what is the axis of resistance and the axis of assistance. Now, the axis of assistance in the region, for any penetration that we're talking about, for any tahawun, complacency, for any unfortunate disappointments that have taken place, when you compare it to the very material relationship and investment in Israel's project for the region that is present among the axis of assistance, I think the picture becomes clearer in terms of what are the sides of this equation. So in the case, for example, of the UAE, what you have is currently the Israeli airspace managed by a private Israeli company called Highlander Aviation. Now, Highlander Aviation is partially owned by the UAE government through a UAE state-owned company called the Edge Group. So the Edge Group is a part owner of Israel's airspace. That's the UAE government. What you also have is several UAE companies. Let me just clarify, UAE, not EU, companies which are staffed by former Israeli intelligence personnel. But moreover, the UAE uses Cellebrite to hack phones of its own citizens. Now, Cellebrite is an Israeli intelligence company founded by former Unit 8200 figures, which its CEO has claimed that they have remote control access to everything gathered by Cellebrite in other countries. So what you're basically having is the UAE outsourcing the hacking of its citizens' phones to Cellebrite. Mm. In addition to that, Osama Hamdan from the political office of Hamas stated that the UAE used the cover of humanitarian aid in Gaza to identify locations of rocket launches and thus assist Israel in its bombing of Gaza. What you also have, and this is really one of the most fascinating parts of the picture, is Jared Kushner founded throughout the Abraham Accords something called Affinity Partners. Now, Jared Kushner is so close to Netanyahu and his family so close to that Netanyahu used to stay in his bedroom.
Really?
When Jared Kushner was at college playing basketball and Netanyahu used to come and visit the United States, he used to stay in Jared Kushner's bedroom.
What was he doing in
there? So check it. Kushner established this Affinity Partners and said, this is to serve as a corridor, a corridor for Gulf investment in Israel. So who puts in money for it? The Saudis put in $2 billion. The UAE puts in a bit less. Qatar puts in some. Okay. Jared Kushner purchases with that money something called the Shlomo Group. Now, the Shlomo Group is the largest producer of Israel's navy.
Really?
It's the largest vehicle company in Israel. And it's armed several key Israeli units since October 7th. The Shaldag unit, which was involved in the massacre of a Shifat hospital. So think about it this way. You have money flowing directly from the UAE and Saudi into this. I mean, there needs to be more clarity about this. People need to have more access to this information. And again, Saudi have hacked the phones of their citizens with Cellebrite, which is an Israeli intelligence company. So normalization has happened. They also obviously have the history of hacking the phone of Jamal Khashoggi with Pegasus, which again is an arm of the Israeli Ministry of Defense. So we're in a worrying time in terms of if UAE and Saudi influence in the region and even in this country will begin to be conditioned with some form of either quietism or support for Israel, then the cultural change that Israel wants to establish in the region, which is normalization at the point of a gun, becomes more and more difficult to discern. And the social engineering becomes more and more successful because it's now taking place. You know, with the case of the Egyptians, for example, they have been reliable to the Israelis in terms of the nuts and bolts and the logistics of the blockade of Gaza. But they don't have the same kind of record as sort of entrepreneurial service to Israel, which the UAE is establishing for itself. You know, one of the key stipulations of the Abraham Accords was that there has to be, if I remember correctly, $10 billion worth of investment by the UAE in Israel over the next few years. I mean, that's incredible. That's a major boost to the Israeli economy. But also, what we're seeing is an increased security, intelligence, and military integration between these forces. So you have, in a way, an established sort of tripartite influence within the region of the UAE, Saudis, and Israel, with really Israel calling the shots. And so that's concerning. That's really concerning for the future of everyone in the region.
So how do we combat this? We've diagnosed a lot of the issues here.
Yeah.
And all these connections are, I think people are going to be really shocked about, especially, I mean, in the beginning when you were talking about that situation with Bill Clinton, I'm still trying to think about this. You know, someone of that power can absolutely be leveraged in that way, potentially.
Yeah, potentially. You know. I mean, the case with the Egyptians, before I forget, is the recent story that is circulating in the Israeli media. But again, sometimes I believe that these stories are put out to try and muddy the waters, but that the assassination, the killing of Yahya Sinwar involved him being lured by Egyptian intelligence to that spot that he was killed. Really? Of course, there's the other story, which is that he was active in operations and was then killed in response
That's the official story.
It's the official story, and believable. And believable too. But it is interesting if the luring of him, because
what's the luring of it? Where did you get that from? Where did you hear
So it's been discussed in the Israeli media and also reported by several figures within Arabic language media. Again, I'm not sure how much
how would they significance. Know that? How would they know that where he is? Because they don't have any presence in Gaza, do they?
The Egyptians?
Yeah.
Not that I know of, but my understanding is that he was not using mobile phones, and so he was apparently, according to this testimony, seeking more information. The Egyptians had said they had more information to pass on to him from Rafah about the negotiations, and so then he went to the location, and the Egyptian passed on the information about the location to the Israelis. Again, though, it doesn't seem to ring true with the series of events that led to his death. So it's hard to know for sure. Yeah, but
they were saying that he was trying to fight them,
and then they his hand was removed, and I mean, you know, his hand was shot off, and then the drone came in to check on his state. But you know, and there is a lesson from all of this. Israel and Zionism has always been very top-heavy as a project. It's always looked to achieve change top-down rather than bottom-up. So therefore, it has taken a policy to attempt to decapitate organizations.
Yeah, that's what they're doing. Yeah.
So, for example, has that been successful historically? In 1935, the British thought they could end the Palestinian cause by assassinating Izzeddin al-Qassam. Today, you have a group that names themselves after Izzeddin al-Qassam and names their rockets after al-Qassam, wreaking havoc for Israel. The lesson from that is actually the greater the repression and the targeting of the leaders does not demoralize the rank and file.
I mean, this is what John Mearsheimer was saying as well too.
Right.
A lot of in his previous interviews with Morgan and other places.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's saying it just doesn't, strategically, doesn't actually mean much.
Achieve what they want. Yeah. And I guess that's why they want the curriculum angle, which is the cultural change throughout the region. They want to remove Hezbollah from the entire political process of Israel. Of Lebanon, and then reconfigure the Lebanese political system. And this is a war of attrition. It could take 10 years. If they want to try and achieve that, I don't think they will, but it would take 10 years to even try and achieve that. Because, and this is an interesting part of it. So when Israel killed Abbas al-Musawi and his baby and his wife in the 90s, the idea was that Hezbollah is finished. Okay, what then happens is Hezbollah beats Israel in 2000, and beats them in 2006 with only 3,000 fighters. At that time, they had 9,000 fighters, but they kept the majority of them in reserve and only sent 3,000 to fight the Israelis and were able to defeat them. The problem, the difference now is that Israel, since 2012, specifically since the Oslo Accords, has a massive informational advantage over the entire region through its technological advancement, through the development of Unit 9900,
yeah,
through development of Unit 8200. But then, you know, you've got the other case with the PFLP. They killed Ghassan Kanfani. They killed him in the car with his niece Lemis. But what did the PFLP later do? They later killed the highest ranking Israeli minister that has ever been killed in the history of Israel. The Minister of Tourism was assassinated by the PFLP after that. And then they killed Abu Ali Mustafa. But then you have the case of Hamas. The entire founding of Hamas, the founders of Hamas were all killed. Abdelaziz Al-Antisi, Ahmed Yassin. Hamas is still fighting today. The Jihad al-Islami, Fatih al-Shiqaqi, they killed him, they assassinated him too. PIJ still fighting today. So the lesson from the history ultimately is that the decapitation model, it just doesn't work. Israel excels at killing. It kills as it breathes. It kills as it breathes. But it's fighting an unwinnable war. It's fighting an unwinnable war. You don't measure the success of war in your ability to kill the most vulnerable on an industrial scale. You measure it on the resonance of your ideas. You measure it in terms of your power of persuasion and convincing the largest number of people that you were right.
Mm.
And that's why it's fighting in a very short term and blind, wrong-headed way. But ultimately, Zionism as an idea is unsustainable.
Mm.
It's unsustainable, this idea that alien invaders can impose on another group of people their will and keep them under their boot indefinitely.
What can we do as people now, because obviously you've been spearheading the activism here in the UK and the Western Hemisphere and the English-speaking world, what well, could
maybe just
be one of the figures? I think you're one of the main figures. I mean, yeah. Surely, like, you're one of the
not, main not figures. The Western Hemisphere. I'd I mean, say like, you're this country.
Multiple Piers Morgan appearances. Your work on... your involvement in Twitter and stuff like that, you're most tweeted and retweeted.
But not Western Hemisphere.
This well, is, I mean, this is, I mean, who?
Thank you,
my question to you is, for a lot of people now that they really want to get involved, they want to do stuff, practically what can we do to help?
I think we need to strengthen our capacity to research. We need to work out the way around Companies House. We need to work out the way around the Charity Commission website. We need to work out the way of looking at the tax filings in the United States, which you can do for organizations which are tax exempt.
What are we trying to do with that?
So for example, with this is... this is risk assessment and awareness all at the same time. I'm not going into this list just, say, for the debate against this clown. I was going into this list because we need to know, you know, you've got individuals on here which fund major British universities. You've got individuals on here which receive £15 million of funding from the British government every year. That work very closely with the police, that provide the police information on who to arrest at different times, that will have targeted the police pertaining to yourself or any other immediate influencers that have taken particular anti-pro-Palestinian positions. So we need
research teams to look at this.
We absolutely. And we need to, it needs to be a cultural change here.
Should we start with the list, like each name? Or?
Oh, wonderful. I mean, I think if I had more time, I would have looked into more of these individuals, because then it reveals what this operation is.
Because
the operation doesn't announce itself. It doesn't brag.
Mm.
It doesn't brag at all. And so...
I mean, just like, for example, practically speaking, you connecting Rupert Murdoch to Piers Morgan and connecting Netanyahu to Rupert Murdoch, that chain of connection has allowed everyone to see the bias in Piers Morgan. It's just a simple tactic. So we can translate those connections into activism.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Is that the model of doing it then, do you think? Making those connections and showing people?
Absolutely. And I think also the infrastructure of how this functions, because, you know, Britain, while it's not the biggest armor of Israel, 15% of the F-35 is made here.
Mm.
over 100 companies in this operate in this country that have involvement in the construction of the F-35. The Arms Trade Treaty, Britain should not be exporting arms to Israel. It's a signatory to the Arms Trade Treaty.
So there's, how do we ensure that?
I mean, I advocate for Palestine Action, which shuts down the factories. Yes, there's risk involved in that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that anyone involved in Palestine Action has to go into the factories themselves. There's other things they can do behind the scenes to assist.
Organization or are yes. they a company or
what? No, an organization which targets Israeli
they go arms in and do physical stuff
sites. Yeah, so for example, Palestine Action has succeeded in permanently shutting down three sites belonging to Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms company in this country.
Are they trained to jump like over the fences and
there's
like
training days, there's training days which people can attend.
Yes, and they go to prison or what happens to them?
So we currently have 16 political prisoners from Palestine Action in this country.
Really? Inside the prison?
In UK, yeah.
Is it? How long are they serving
sentences? So 10 of them are on remand and 6 of them have been sentenced. It was for one that took place in Scotland. However, it's worth emphasising here that Palestine Action since October 7th has carried out 130 operations against Israeli military companies. Well,
according to the UK
and
law.
And since 2020, 500 operations since then. Now, those the legality of them...
For them, that's a trade-off they're willing to
Yeah, accept. And the legality of them is then hashed out in the court. And the vast majority, and this is important to note, vast majority of people that have been arrested have actually not been charged. But really? Then the ones that have been charged and have then entered the court have been able to make the sound argument that they are trying to... apply, you know, there's
so they made a legal argument.
All of us have a solid legal argument. Let me explain how.
Yeah.
So number one, Palestine Action comes into the court and it says, look, according to Article 1 of the Genocide Convention, anybody that is a part of this should stop those carrying out genocide and cease the commission of it and stop supporting it. Now, one of the ways Britain should do that is by stopping its arms sales. Yeah. But what you also have is the basis through which humanitarian intervention is when Yemen is blockading the Red Sea and forcing the Eilat port to bankrupt, it is, in my mind, and we can say this, performing a humanitarian intervention. The same argument can be made for other organizations in the region. Palestine Action has a similar position. It's just based here. And so what we need...
Are they classified as a terrorist organization?
No, but they've been... So there's another important part of the story is that the US... the British government advisor on political violence and domestic extremism is an individual by the name of Lord Walney. Now, Lord Walney has been funded by the European Leadership Network, which is an Israel lobby group. It's included on the Voices of Israel Ministry of Diaspora Affairs project. So it's clearly a foreign agent. He's been funded by them. He's also been funded by a consortium of arms companies, which includes some of the arms companies that Palestine Action is targeting. Now, he has recommended that there is a designation that should take
They're
place.
They're not Muslim, the majority of them, isn't it?
You know, Fatima Rajwani, who's one of the political prisoners of Palestine Action, is a Muslim woman.
Well, would you say the majority of them? I mean, from your,
I would say if we were to look at the people that have carried out operations, the majority of them are non-Muslim.
Yeah,
and actually, this to some extent it testifies to the sort of resonance of the Palestinian cause at this particular period of time.
That does, to be honest,
but you know, of course, you have the history of, you know, the Japanese group that carried out, the Red Army carried out, you know, an operation at the Lid airport, and have a history. Many of them are in Lebanon now. The Japanese Red Army individuals that fought alongside the Palestinians in the 80s. So there is a
so that's for another way of doing so research. And then you've spoken about the case of the Palestinian activists. Palestine Action. What else would you say?
I mean, to be honest, you know, I wouldn't necessarily be the best person to advise, because within the little square that I'm in, I'm sort of doing what I can with limited success. You know, there's been ways in which we've been able to enforce our will on them. And, you know, there's a price to pay. I'm not saying that everyone watching this should, you know, you yourself, for example, have had your name written on a missile.
You had that was, as well, right?
No, I didn't, interestingly. But not everyone wants to be in that position.
Mm.
And not everyone wants to...
I'm sure they're going to put your name on a missile now.
You know, I don't rule out anything.
Yeah.
And I'm in
Have you had any like anyone threatening you or anything like that?
Of course.
Really, yeah?
Of course.
Yeah. Physically, like?
I've received messages from people who are serving Israeli soldiers otherwise.
Yeah. But I mean, in like face-to-face, has anyone come to you? Has anyone tried it?
No.
Okay.
No. I think the Speaker's Corner would make that more of a likelihood.
Yeah, actually. Yeah, of course, yeah. Are you coming down?
No. But in terms of my situation, I think ultimately you have to reach, in order to be effective, you've got to reach a state of tranquility with all eventualities.
Mm.
And once you reach that, I think you can be effective. I think if there is that internal barrier, then you will always be held back. And actually part of their propaganda is that they are the all-powerful, all-enforcing, and that you really can't escape what they want to do. And their will sort of be the decisive factor. It's not true. And, you know, we know that's not true. So, I mean, we're headed for a really fascinating and tough decade. So, but I've taken so much of your time, guys.
Thank you so much. Before we end this... People don't know that because he's been so involved in the activism for such a long time. People don't know that, you know, low key. I mean, people will know that actually. You were quite a famous rapper, weren't you, for some time? Are you still doing it?
Yeah, I still make music, not so much. More of my time is spent on
the activism
and media.
Would you say now that you're more of an activist or more of a rapper?
I'd say more media.
Is it?
Yeah, more media.
The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam told us that when the son of Adam dies, all of his good deeds are interrupted. They are finished, except for three things. Sadaqatun jariyah, a continuous charity, and a beneficial knowledge, and also a righteous offspring that makes dua for him. Your brothers and sisters in Islam Net from Norway are establishing a masjid, a dawah center, and fulfilling a great portion of this hadith on your behalf. Establishing a masjid to convey the message of Islam is one of the best deeds a Muslim can do. Whenever someone prays there, whenever someone gives shahada in the masjid, whenever someone learns something in the masjid, yes, that will be something that you'll have on your scale. So give generously and Allah Azza wa Jal will give you even more.